Stand by. This hour is being brought to you by AlmostFreeTeeth.com. Save on dental implants today.
You guys haven't had that late comeback in the final innings yet this season. How would you like to see the team kind of approach, and what can you do to maybe break through in the final innings in general?
There's no magic potion, I'm telling you. I mean, it's just baseball. Those things will happen. That's not a lack of wanting to and things like that. If you think that's the case, I don't know if you know the game. It's just, that's part of the game.
Ooh. Terry Francona, Reds manager, doing the old questioning a reporter. I don't know if you know the game. I wasn't expecting that from nice guy Terry Francona. Oh, my. As we welcome you back into the Rahimi and Harris show, it is Mark Grody and Dan Wiederer in for those two, who will return, I believe, on Tuesday. And I get to occasionally join those guys as well. So shout out to Layla. Shout out to Marshall. Layla did an unbelievably great job last night with the Chicago Sky. So we're giving her a little bit of rest today. And Dan and I are taking care of things here today. The Cubs play Terry Francona's Cincinnati Reds today. It is a 5:40 game right here on the Score. Really good pitching matchup. Matthew Boyd against the very good Hunter Green, who's just actually returning from a groin injury. So that is the mound matchup today. But there is plenty to talk about in Cincinnati, not just the Reds. And we will talk about the Reds. But there is a certain player for Cincinnati that is not happy, that would probably make a lot of other teams happy too, and that is Trey Hendrickson, who plays for the Cincinnati Bengals. So let us, without further ado, bring in Mo Egger, who is an afternoon host on ESPN 1530 in Cincinnati. He joins us on the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline, CircaLasVegas.com. Thank you so much for joining us, Mo. What's going on, man?
Just spending a beautiful Friday afternoon in Cincinnati traffic. It's great.
Oh, in the natty. Well, guess what? Guess what, Mo? We probably spend a lot more time in traffic than you do. Don't come at us with traffic complaints, Mo.
But that's why it's frustrating, because we typically don't have traffic, yeah. Right? I go to Chicago. I'm coming up next weekend. I expect to sit in traffic. When I leave my house on the west side of Cincinnati for my 18-minute drive to work, I don't expect it to take an hour and a half, and here we are.
Leave early. That is the best thing I can say if you live in the great, big, beautiful city of Chicago, and I do love Cincinnati as well. When last, Mo, I saw the Cincinnati Reds playing a full ball game, they were here in Tower. Well, maybe it was at the Reds. I don't even remember now. But it was a game against the Chicago White Sox, and in that game, Ellie De La Cruz hit a game-tying home run, and then it was Miguel Vargas hitting a three-run homer, and the Reds lost by a final score of 5-1. Was that not necessarily the dramatic nature of that loss, but the lack of run support until the very end of that game, was that somewhat symbolic of what's been going on with the Cincinnati Reds this year?
Yeah, I think if there was a game that sort of encapsulates what this season has been like for the Reds, it was that one, because that night the starting pitching was really, really good. The bats were non-existent. Obviously, Ellie hit the home run, which forced extra innings, but I think what this season has been for the first 51 games has been confirmation of what we suspected. I think we suspected coming into the season the Reds were going to have really good starting pitching. You were just talking about Hunter Green. Obviously, did spend some time on the injured list, but for the most part, he has been terrific. Heading a rotation, the top to bottom, for the most part, has been really good. The bullpen, for the most part, has been really good. The offense has been, I think, to a degree, even slightly worse than we expected. We didn't expect it to be a great offense, but, you know, you mentioned Ellie De La Cruz. Ellie is not having a terrible season, but he's not having a great one either. And I think this team was built around him being great. I think they were built around Matt McClain being as good as he was 2 years ago. That hasn't happened at all. And I think it was built around Tyler Stevenson, their catcher, who I thought coming into the season had a chance to maybe be a National League All-Star. He spent some time on the injured list. When he came back, he started to not hit. He has lots of company there. This team offensively has all sorts of issues. They have played 51 games, and in 15 of them, they have scored either 0 runs or 1 run.
Mo, you mentioned Hunter Green, and he'll get the start tonight. How would you describe what his magic is and what he's done to kind of spearhead that rotation?
You know, to put it simply, it's kind of cliche. I think he's learned to pitch, right? We are all familiar with Hunter Green, you know, the kid who was on the cover of Sports Illustrated when he was in high school, the blazing fastball, the ability to hit triple digits. All that is well and good. He wasn't really going to make a name for himself as a high-end, top-of-the-rotation, all-star caliber big league pitcher until he developed other pitches and then until he trusted himself to throw them at any point in the count. And so that evolution has been fun to watch. You know, Hunter got here in 2022, which was a miserable season for the Reds, and we saw flashes. You know, he threw an eight-inning no-hitter against the Pittsburgh Pirates. But at some point, he was going to have to start developing secondary stuff. And once he did, he was going to have to start showing a willingness to throw pretty much any pitch at any point in the count to any hitter, and use the blazing fastball, use triple digits when necessary. That has happened. He is a complete, well-rounded pitcher with a good arsenal. He'll throw anything at any point in the count. He doesn't screw around up there and fall behind. I think earlier in his career, he would always have that one inning, right, where he'd be cruising along for the first two or three and then suddenly have a 35-pitch inning, and he was knocked out well before you would expect your staff ace to be knocked out. Now, heck, he nearly threw a complete game against the San Francisco Giants, and you never see those. He's become more pitch efficient. He's trusting all of his pitches. He was an all-star last year, and he has continued that pace this season.
Yeah, he's act 4-2 with a 2.36 ERA, and indeed, just a short stint on the DL or the injured list, coming back from that groin injury that was May 7th. So he probably will still be in pretty good condition. Didn't take a lot for him to get it back on here. Matthew Boyd against Hunter Green. Let's get back to Terry Francona. I probably should have asked you about that bite that he had right out of there, man. He's like get a little testy Terry right there. What's going on with that? How has he been taken here? Because, you know, Terry Francona is about as credible as it gets of a manager in Major League Baseball now and maybe all time, really.
Yeah, you know, we played that cut a lot on our show yesterday.
Bet
the guy
you did.
Who asked the question is a dude by the name of Charlie Goldsmith. And frankly, I don't think Terry Francona was coming after Charlie. I think Terry was sort of coming after the idea that, well, it's a matter of want to when it comes to their inability to mount comebacks late in games. But, you know, he's just kind of been there. He's certainly affable. The people who cover the team will talk about how accommodating he is. You know, a lot has been written about, you know, Tito bringing a level of accountability to the team that I think was lacking last season. And I think that's been somewhat evident. But, you know, the reality is this team still has to win in the margins because they lack firepower offensively. Last year's team frustrated a lot of us because they weren't good in the field and they weren't good on the bases. They didn't do the little things very well. We saw a recurrence of issues that ultimately got last year's manager fired. I don't think those things have been extinguished. I think when the Reds have been at their most frustrating, you're still seeing, you know, defensive miscues that don't necessarily show up in the box score, right? Like a ball being cut off that shouldn't be cut off, or the Reds giving up an extra base. And base running, I guess recently it's been a little bit better, but it still hasn't been as good as it needs to be. The other day in Pittsburgh, Spencer Steer was thrown out by a mile trying to score on a ball to left field. The sort of things we often saw last year seemingly haven't really been corrected, and I think that would be the biggest criticism of Terry Francona to this point.
Does Charlie Goldsmith know baseball? Does he know baseball?
Charlie Goldsmith might know more about baseball than anybody in this city not named Terry Francona.
Shout out to Charlie Goldsmith, then.
Mo, through the lens of what you just talked about, obviously the Reds get on a little surge. They have the weekend sweep of the Guardians last week, go to Pittsburgh, win the first one, and then you end up losing a series in Pittsburgh where you only give up five runs. What does this weekend mean in terms of a measuring stick series against a team that's playing really good baseball right now?
Well, you know, you could talk about measuring stick, but you could also talk about, like, where they are in relation to the Cubs. They're going to play them six times over the next 9 days. They have a 5.5-game deficit. If you're serious about winning the division, close that gap and do it by beating the team that leads the National League Central. I don't think it's so much about the measuring stick. I think it's just more about when you're 25-26 and you've told the world you think you can contend, okay, that's got to start at some point. no better team to have it start against than the Chicago Cubs. But you're right. You know, you referenced the Pirates series this week. I'm sure many of your listeners saw the White Sox series last week. They're 1-2 against the Miami Marlins. They're 1-2 against the Chicago White Sox. They lost 2 out of 3 this week to the Pittsburgh Pirates. This team has to clean up against the dregs of the league. They haven't done that. So what does that do? It puts added importance on being the teams that, you know, are better than you. And I think top to bottom, a fair assessment would conclude that the Chicago Cubs are better than the Cincinnati Reds. And so I think a lot of us were hoping they would go to Pittsburgh, win 2 out of 3, come in with a measure of momentum instead of needing to win this series. Now they kind of have to if they're going to be taken seriously in the National League Central, because if you just lose 2 out of 3, you come out of Memorial Day 6.5 back. And with teams between yourself and first place, that's not where you want to be.
Wasn't it in Pittsburgh where Ellie De La Cruz hit that absolute bomb? Am I right about that? Like about a 450-footer?
This week?
No, it was like earlier this year. It was earlier this year.
Earlier this year. It was against Pittsburgh, yes. Yeah. He hit one. If anybody has ever been to a Great American Ballpark, there's this big riverboat up high in dead center field.
Yeah, that might have been it, yeah.
And Ellie hit it. And that edifice has been up since, I think, 2007 or 2008. I don't think anybody had ever hit it before.
Yeah.
When he gets a hold of one, they are these majestic punts that wow you. The problem is we don't see them nearly often enough.
We are talking to Mo Egger of ESPN 1530 in Cincinnati. He is their afternoon host. This segment being brought to you by AlmostFreeTeeth.com. Save on dental implants today. It is the Rahimi and Harris Show featuring Mark Grody and Dan Wiederer today. We get to be with you here until 2 o'clock. I got one more quick Reds thing. It's actually a trivia question that I have for you, Mo, and then we got to talk about the Cincinnati Bengals. Okay, ready? I'm putting you on the spot here, man. Yeah. This is tough because it goes back a little bit. But in the name of the Chicago Cubs and Wrigley Field, I don't know if you heard this or not, but the Cubs are hosting, or reportedly hosting, per our Bruce Levine, the All-Star Game in the year 2027. It has been since 1990 that Wrigley Field hosted an All-Star Game. Can you, Mo Egger, name the two Reds starters for the National League in that game? I have no idea how old you are, so I might be asking somebody too young to answer these questions, but do you remember who the two starters for the Reds were in the All-Star Game in the year 1990?
Dude, come on. I was 13 years old in 1990.
Wheelhouse stuff here.
What I remember was there was a rain delay, right?
Yes, there was.
Wrigley Field at night, right? Uh-huh. So for the 1990 World Series champion, Cincinnati Reds, Jack Armstrong from Neptune, New Jersey, started. And what was amazing about that was he started the All-Star game, and then by the time October rolled around, he wasn't even in the starting rotation. And Chris Sabo also started that game. And what drove me nuts as a I was soon to turn 13-year-old kid that year, Ozzie Smith started at shortstop for the National League, which was total BS.
Barry Larkin.
It should have been Barry Larkin.
Yes, you're right.
The voters were stupid. Uh-huh. Those stupid voters also put in Lenny Dykstra and not Eric Davis.
Nails.
So there should have been 4 Reds who started that game for the National League at Wrigley Field. They got 2 hit and lost 2-0 because the people who voted for the starters screwed up.
Oh, man. That is good stuff. Oh,
hazy
the way,
memory from Mo on the 1990 All-Star game.
By the way, I'll throw this out there. There's one other little tidbit here. I was going to use this later, but why not now? There was the rain delay in the 7th inning, and check this out, guys. They didn't just keep the broadcast there. They played the program Rescue 911. Oh, that was something.
Wow.
Yeah, instead of doing
Bill Shatner.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Bill Shatner, man. That was the beginning of his comeback. All right, we got it. We have to get into the Cincinnati Bengals and what the latest is going on right now with Trey Hendrickson and where he is and if he's going to be with the Bengals and if Bengals fans want him to be with the Bengals or they want him to trade him. Tell us everything.
Well, I think the way most reasonable people look at it is that neither side is necessarily wrong in terms of their just general stance. Trey Hendrickson led the league in sacks last year, was a defensive player of the year finalist, and was the only good player on an otherwise terrible defense. So he wants to be the highest paid edge rusher in the league, or at least one of the few highest paid edge rushers in the league. I can't blame him. And the Cincinnati Bengals look at Trey Hendrickson, who's under contract for this season. He's going to turn 31 by the end of this year.
Yep.
And they look at him and go, there's a pretty good chance his best years are behind him. And I don't think that stance is necessarily wrong. So, look, number one, the Bengals have offered him a raise and a contract extension. And if you believe the reporting that's out there, and I do, the raise would basically be a 75% raise from about $16 million to $28 million. That's pretty good. That's not good enough for Trey Hendrickson. So is there going to be, you know, if you go back to the owners' meetings, Katie Blackburn, who is essentially the owner of the Bengals, said in so many words, Trey Hendrickson's just going to have to be happy with what we have offered, which tells me there's our offer. Mm. We're digging in. And if you know anything about the history of the Cincinnati Bengals, once they say they're done negotiating, they're done negotiating. So I think the next question becomes, number one, does Trey Hendrickson become a distraction this during training camp? Because I don't know if you guys saw the video last week of Trey coming to the voluntary off-season workout, standing there while his teammates are practicing, and he's grandstanding to the media. Do we see more spectacles like that? And then number two, does he decide to miss football games? Does he decide to extend a holdout into the regular season, and do the Bengals miss him? Or did the Bengals go, okay, we're going to have to figure out a way to get this done? I think anybody who tells you they know how this is going to end is lying. Trey Hendrickson is a different type of guy. That doesn't mean he's a bad guy, but I think this can go in any number of directions. But, you know, again, I don't think either side is necessarily incorrect. And by the way, number one, Trey Hendrickson signed a one-year contract extension for this coming season 2 years ago. He shouldn't have done that. Number two, what we're never going to know is, what would the Bengals be doing with Trey Hendrickson if they didn't reverse course and sign T. Higgins to the deal that they weren't going to give him until Joe Burrow made them?
That's where I was going to go next, Mo, because part of the reason that money is tight in Cincinnati is because you're paying a big-time quarterback money. You've got a wide receiver, one that has earned the contract that Ja'Marr Chase has gotten, and T. Higgins comes back on that deal. Given those dynamics, how do you describe the window that the Bengals must attack now that they have those three pieces all together and united on big, big deals?
I think it has to happen in the next 3 years. Look, I think there have only been five quarterbacks who have won their first ever Super Bowl after they've played 8 years. And so, you know, let's be honest about that. If we're sitting here having this conversation 2 years from now about the Bengals with Joe Burrow putting up a bunch of gaudy numbers and having not won the title, I think we're going to be having discussions about what happens if they still don't win a title after that third year, if that makes sense, and I'm not sure it does. The window is open. I think the question is, you know, it was a huge organizational failure last year. Joe Burrow was an MVP finalist on a team that didn't make the postseason. They wasted greatness from their quarterback. Have they fixed their defense and offensive line this offseason enough to ensure that that doesn't happen again? That's a matter of debate. But, I think there's a lot of urgency. And by the way, I think after having retooled a lot of the coaching staff, now the arrow is pointing at head coach Zach Taylor. If we're having a conversation in late January and the Bengals haven't even made the postseason or are one and done, I think it's going to be interesting to hear what we're saying about Zach Taylor.
Yeah, yeah. They were 9-8 last year. The Bears will be visiting the Bengals. Was week 8, is that?
November 2nd.
Yeah, the Bears.
November 2nd.
Yeah. Bears at the bank. For some reason, I don't know why, because we're all out of our minds. I think I picked the Bears to win that game. I don't know if they're actually going to win that game, though, Dan.
Can I just ask a brief question as a beat writer traveling to Cincinnati for that game? Where should I go that weekend? What's my must-hit spot?
Montgomery Inn. Am I right about that, Mo, or no?
You're not going to get any argument from me as it relates to the Montgomery Inn. I think you have to go to the one in Montgomery, not the one downtown.
Oh, okay.
I think the original is the place to be, so you're going to have to drive to the burbs just a little bit. It sort of depends on what you're into. The area between the stadiums is really cool. Every Cincinnatian is going to tell you got to try Skyline Chili, which I think is awesome. The big steakhouse in town is Jeff Ruby's Steakhouse, which you know, pretty much anybody who comes to town goes and visits. There's no shortage. And if you're a beer guy, we got a billion breweries here. So there's no shortage of beer, if that's your thing, too.
In.
Yeah, there you go. All right, now the very last question here, and then we do got to go. Your favorite Reds player of all time is?
It's Barry Larkin.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, so I'll give you the top five.
Oh, good.
Right? My five all-time favorite Reds players are Barry Larkin.
Uh-huh.
Dave Parker, who goes into the Hall of Fame this summer, well overdue, the Cobra.
I love the Cobra.
Eric Davis.
Amazing player.
Johnny Cueto, terrific pitcher.
Love Cueto. He was here for a little while.
Yeah, and the great Joey Votto.
Oh, that's a pretty good list right there, man. None of the big red machine, huh? Maybe that's out of your wheelhouse.
No Mario Soto.
You know, I was born in 77. So,
yeah, I got you.
I got opinions about all those guys.
Rob Dibble.
I like Rob Dibble a lot, too.
Who doesn't like? Mo, this has been great, man. We could definitely talk to you longer, but the show dictates that we move on because we got to talk more Bears here, man. So I appreciate you.
My condolences. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Mo.
That's Mo Egger from ESPN 1530 in Cincinnati, talking about the Reds and talking about the Bengals. We had the right guy in the air, didn't we?
Total dud in remembering the 1990 All-Star Game. Yeah. He didn't remember a single thing.
Yeah, no, nothing at all. I was enabling him. I was giving him excuses. He's like, player, please.
He gave you the entire box score.
We'll talk more about that later. But coming up next, more Bears. Let's get fishy. Fishy business. Kevin Fishbane of The Athletic joins the Raheemy and Harris Show next on The Score.
Kevin Fishbane.
I got fishy business, K. Fishbane.
Bears beat writer for The Athletic.
I also always use the Arrested Development line. There's always money in the banana stand.
How much clearer can I say? There's always money in the banana stand!
Kevin Fishbane talking Bears.
Hey, Kevin. Kevin Fishbane from The Athletic.
I love your name.
It's a great name.
Yeah, great name.
On Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
Guys, fishier than ever. As we welcome you back into the Raheemy and Harris Show, being hoisted by Mark Grody and Dan Wiederer today.
Fishiest guy in the media room by far at Halas Hall, correct?
I mean, you never know what he's up to. Yeah. He's always talking to somebody in there, like, you know what's going on? The whispers of Kevin Fishbane and
fishy.
The fishy comments. I mean, it's all there. But yes, Dan and I host the Take the North podcast together. We are hanging out with you until 2 o'clock today. We've got five on it, five best topics of the day that we will kick around coming up at noon. But joining us now, without further ado, on the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline is the one and only Kevin Fishbane, senior writer at The Athletic, covering the Chicago Bears, and he too has a podcast. He is the host of the Breaking In with Kevin Fishbane, a sports media podcast. Fishy business, what's happening, man?
Happy Friday, boys. It's great to be with you.
3-day weekend, Fishy. It's a 3-day weekend. We're getting ready for it. We're going to start with a little Bears question. We'll get to your podcast in a couple minutes. But Grody and I have been talking for a couple months now about the temptation that Chicago is going to have, Bears fans are going to have, media members are going to have to bite every little shiny lure of Ben Johnson hype that's out there. How do you kind of contextualize what we're experiencing with Ben in the early stages and resist the temptation to make the proclamation that some already have, that it's all different now, it's never been this good, it's all different now?
Dan, I like when fans have high hopes. Let them, let their imaginations run wild. But, the story of the week, right, was that we saw Ben Johnson's demeanor at practice. And so I sat there and I thought, what do I remember from May and June storylines for first-year head coach? I remember John Fox fixed the culture at Halas Hall. I remember Matt Nagy's offense was aggressive and innovative. I remember Matt Eberflus, we were watching guys hustling and they were hitting in camp and it was just a whole new practice that we had never seen before.
Get your track shoes on, remember?
Exactly. And we saw it that first year. So I could say those things to throw a little water on the bells and whistles and the excitement. What Ben Johnson has going for him, though, like that's a little different, is we could actually look at who he is, what he's accomplished, and say, hey, at least to use a John Fox line, there's skins on the wall there. Not as a head coach, but we know what this guy's accomplished as a play caller. We know how respected he was in Detroit. And we also know that this roster is more talented than some of the ones I just went through. So, you know, it's I think it's important to remember that there have been a lot of coaches here since Lovie Smith, and there was a lot of excitement at times for each of them in season one, but that maybe this guy is supposed to be different, and you know, of course we won't really know that until the fall.
And I don't think any of us were covering the Bears when Mark Trestman was here, right? None of us were covering?
I
was going to bring that up, actually, Grody, because I didn't start until Mark Trestman's first training camp.
Oh, Jesus.
And I missed OTAs and minicamp. I got my first day on the Bears beat was the first day of 2013 training camp. And the first practice, I'll never forget, Mark Trestman yelled at the players, "This isn't a symposium," as his way of getting them to kind of move and talk. And I'll never forget like that phrase, because I wondered how many people here, from players, coaches, to support staff, to media, to fans, can define symposium? But there probably were stories that day like, hey, Mark Trestman is really setting the standard here by making sure these players know this is not a symposium.
I'm now picturing, by the way, like a big poster in the locker room with the word symposium and then an X through it. This is not a symposium.
Fish, my first day on the beat, as you may recall, was week one Monday of that same season, Trestman's first year. And my first big assignment at the Tribune was to write a Sunday takeout for week one about the offensive guru that was Mark Trestman. I'm sure we could find that story, read some of the quotes in it, and giggle a little bit about how, it felt good early on. And they set records offensively that first year. It was like, there's going to be flashes, right? And then all, as we all know, the path toward sustained success is much bumpier than most people in Chicago want to realize.
It's about consistency, right? Like you could even talk about like that little brief spurt when the Bears beat the Packers on Thanksgiving in 2015.
And
hey, where's this thing going? Yeah. Right. You could point to 2023. There's plenty of people here who talked about the Justin Fields run in 2022. They didn't win any of those games, but look, we've all gone through this in this town with this team, and it's just about finding. I mean, look, nobody represented that more than Matt Nagy, Coach of the Year, 2018.
Yep.
Like, there were not people. I mean, you know, I always remember the Giants game from that year because that was the first time we kind of saw these little questions about clock management and some decision making. You lost to a team you probably shouldn't have lost to, and then you know, you point to the playoff loss. But I mean, you guys remember what this city was like the summer of 2019. It was the summer of Mitch. Mm. It was the summer of Matt Nagy. It was like everything, all the bells and whistles. So we've seen these little spurts here and there, and now it's like, can Ben Johnson and Caleb Williams be the ones to give this team some sustained success, right? What was the last time the Bears made the playoffs in back-to-back years? We're talking 20 years now. So that's what they're looking for.
Yeah, and that's what I say, like, too, some of these guys, like we're talking about the older coaches, some of their, believe it or not, even though at the end of Matt Nagy's tenure here, everybody was done with him, every year that goes by, his legacy ages better because he won in 2018. I would say that about Dave Wannstedt, who did not have a good record here, but he won a damn playoff game, and the Bears have won 6 playoff games since 1985. So each of these guys, now John Fox's resume has not aged well, his time here has not aged well, nor has Mark Trestman's, but some of those guys, and I know you, Weeder, you were a fan of Matt Nagy coming in as well. It was time for him to go, but his time here, his legacy, I should say, has aged well.
Yeah, well, people apply some revisionist history to some of what 2018 and 2019 were. Look, like, it's hard. It is hard to sustain success, and you have to realize how steep that climb is. Kev, we've been talking a lot about the Caleb Williams. I called it a rumpus earlier. That's my word of the week for that. You can have whatever opinion you want to have on whether Caleb should have talked this week, when he should talk. But when he does talk, when he gets back up to a lectern, what are the three bullet point questions you want to know first and foremost the next time you get to hear from QB1?
Did you try to get the Bears to trade for Kevin O'Connell? Did you just jump right in?
It's not a bad question.
When you saw that excerpt, I thought there was nothing from Caleb Williams' family, father, in terms of thoughts on the Bears that really, like, nothing knocked me over, like, reading that. was, you know, I think what was interesting was that Caleb himself went on the record in that book. And there were some things about what Caleb was telling people close to him. Like that was kind of new information. And I think Caleb Williams, you think about what he went through last year. I mean, this guy had to talk to us after the Hail Mary, talking to us after his offensive coordinator gets fired, talking to us after his head coach gets fired. He handles everything really well.
Right.
And so I'm not concerned about how he's going to handle it. I think it'll be interesting to know from him, like, what was it that got him to come to terms with wanting, like, the Bears? Like, is he embracing the challenge of what this franchise has gone through? Things like that. And we've already heard him talk about Ben Johnson, but I think it's fair to say, hey, like, you apparently had your visit to Hallis Hall and came out of there and said, I want this. Why? Like, why did you want this? And maybe how close were you to trying to, as in his words, to nuke it, to blow it all up and to, you know, mess with the whole draft process? Yeah, I'm curious to hear more. I want to read more of that chapter. I want to read the whole book. Mm-hmm. It's all fascinating, and I am confident that Caleb Williams knows how to handle this. Like, he has been in the spotlight since he was 15 years old. Like, he's not afraid of this stuff. So I'm looking forward to hearing from him when he does talk.
So, since the second he was on that stage at the Combine, like, that we talked to him, and he was ready for all the questions that he had coming, all that stuff in the pre-draft process that was going on for sure. Kevin, on the field, in the OTAs, what were some of the biggest things you took away from actually the practice that we saw on Wednesday?
You know, we talk about the way Ben Johnson reacted to things, mm-hmm. but I think it's important to talk about the details. I know every single coach says that he's on the details and all that stuff, but like, he wanted these certain things to be so perfect, or maybe not perfect, but like on what he wants this early. And I think there's something to be said about setting that standard in May, because we heard my gosh, the amount of times we heard the word accountability last year was mind-numbing. And now you have this coach who is just, this is how it's going to be in May, without pads, well before our first game. If you are lined up a half a yard outside where you're supposed to be, we're going to talk about it. And I think that's an important thing to see. And again, it's not some revolutionary coaching strategy or tactic. It's just not necessarily one that was very evident last year. And it's not necessarily one that Caleb Williams experienced a whole lot of during his first year. Now, I think there was a lot of coaching and critiques that happened behind closed doors that we didn't see. And I think in some ways, maybe, Dan, you talk about revisionist history. Like, you know, obviously last year's coaching staff didn't work, but I it's not like these guys were just doing nothing. I mean, there was some coaching going on, and there was some, obviously, a lot of things that weren't working on both sides. But I think my takeaway, because you're not going to take a whole lot away from the actual performance right on the field at these things, but I did take note of, okay, how on the details this coach is going to be this soon. He told us, he goes, we just gave him their install. This is day two. Yeah. And he already had some issues with what they were doing, where they were lining up. He wasn't going to let those things slide.
Kevin Fishbane is a senior writer for The Athletic and also the host of the Breaking In with Kevin Fishbane podcast, a sports media podcast specifically. I know you've got the episode with Courtney Cronin up and running right now. Really quickly, Kevin, what was the motivation, the inspiration behind doing this podcast, and who do you have on next?
Well, listen, you guys host a podcast. You do a phenomenal job. And I felt like it was time for me to host a podcast. And I don't want to compete with Take the North.
No, you can't. I mean, that's impossible. Oh,
that's, yeah, you know, yeah. And there's a couple other Savvy Bears podcasts we don't need to name to, you know. So I was like, and I love origin stories. I'm fascinated by people in our industry who've done some incredible things. And I you know, want to know how everybody got their start. Hope to have you guys on the podcast one day. You mentioned Courtney Cronin. Mm-hmm. She was, you know, this week's guest, the first member of Hallis Hall to appear on the podcast. Did a great job. And again, we know each other so well, but I don't really know like what your guys, like what you were doing day to day in your first job. I think it's interesting for people of all walks of life to learn how everybody got their starts in their careers.
Yeah. Happy to tell you if you pay me some money.
Yeah, by the way, yeah, we come with a cost now. That's the way we roll around here, Fishy Business. It's not you. You're not the Fishy Business. The Fishy Business is sitting right here in this studio. Kevin, you're the best, man. Great stuff. I appreciate you.
All right, have a good weekend, guys.
Yeah, Kev. There goes Kevin Fishbane. Yeah, check it out. It's an awesome podcast. Breaking In with Kevin Fishbane, a sports media podcast. You can get like some big-time names that he's gotten on there and the origin stories. And they are interesting because there ain't a whole lot of us that started at the top.
That's
for sure,
if
you consider us to be at the top.
No, sir.
Yeah, and Dan, you and I always talk about our origin stories. But coming up next, we are going to do halftime. We've got some things to discuss, including the All-Star game. And Dan, what do you have?
A little bit of flag football talk, as now the doors are open for flag football at the Olympics.
How about that? It was a topic of conversation out at Hallis Hall, so Dan and I will share coming up next on the Rahimi and Harris Show on The Score.
Layla Rahimi, Marshall Harris, Rahimi and Harris, middays 10 a.m. to 2 on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
What time is it?
It's halftime.
Two quarters in the books, ladies and gentlemen. Mark Grody, Dan Weider are filling in for Rahimi and Harris today on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. We regularly host the Take the North podcast, which you should check out. It is a hot, hot podcast. Today so far on the program, we opened it up with a hot Bears hour talking about the Bears and Caleb Williams and reacting to Ross Tucker, who kind of came in scorched earth on Caleb Williams on the field and off the field. So we invite you to go back on the Odyssey app if you'd like to hear that. Took some of your calls as well. We also had a great conversation with Mo Egger, the afternoon host on ESPN 1530 in Cincinnati, about the Reds and, of course, about Trey Hendrickson of the Bengals, of the 17.5 sacks and the not happy with the numbers that he has in money-wise in Cincinnati. And will he stay? Will he go? Could the Bears possibly be in play for him? And we just had a great conversation with our friend Kevin Fishbane, the senior writer at The Athletic, covering the Chicago Bears.
It's halftime.
That's right. And as you've heard us allude to a couple of times, finally, the Chicago Cubs, per our guy, Bruce Levine, who is a newsbreaker, Bruce Levine letting the world know that Wrigley Field will host the 2027 Major League Baseball All-Star Game. There had been security concerns through the years and, you know, Wrigley Field, logistics. Like I said, there's an opportunity cost with Wrigley Field. It's a beautiful ballpark, but there are things that are not ideal about the ballpark always. The Cubs, or the Wrigley Field, however you want to put it, have not hosted an All-Star game since 1990. In that year, the American League beat the National League by a final score of 2-1. As we alluded to with the great Mo Egger, there was a rain delay in the seventh inning during which Rescue 911 was played. So I thought that was interesting. And just for the hell of it, and I asked Mo Egger, our Cincinnati guy, a trivia question, and he was able to answer the two Reds starters in that lineup that year. And he was all like Jack Armstrong, and who is the other one? Chris Sabo, the goggle wearing Chris Sabo.
Rec Specs.
Yeah, that's right. Here was the lineups, the starters, I should say, for the National League and the American League. For the National League, it was Jack Armstrong of the Reds as the starting pitcher. The catcher, Mike Socha,
all right,
of the Dodgers. One of my favorite players of all time that's not a Cub, Will Clark of the Giants. What a sweet swing that guy had.
Yep.
Ryne Sandberg was, of course, the starting second baseman, as he was for many years with the Chicago Cubs. Chris Sabo,
the third base,
aforementioned third baseman, the goggle wearing one. Ozzie Smith, and maybe it should have been Barry Larkin, but it was Ozzie Smith starting.
The Wizard.
And then in the outfield, Dan, you told me your favorite Cub of all time.
Andre Dawson.
The Hawk was one of the outfielders. Lenny Dykstra was a starter. Maybe it should have been Eric Davis. And then the other guy, the very puffy, large, strong Kevin Mitchell. Remember Kevin Mitchell?
Yeah, of course. I thought you were going to go John Kruk there.
But truck.
Once you said puffy and large, but it was Kevin Mitchell.
No, Kevin, you remember he was puffy.
Oh, yeah.
He was a puffy man. from the American League, your American League starters that year. This is Bob Welch of the Oakland Athletics. He was good. Sandy Alomar Jr. of the Alomars was the starting catcher. Mark McGuire, the first baseman of the Oakland Athletics. Sexy was the starting second baseman. That'd be Steve Sachs. He was with the Yankees at the time. The third baseman, another one of my favorite players of all time. I loved contact guys back in the day. Wade Boggs, the third baseman for the Red Sox. The shortstop, of course, it was Cal Ripken. Hoskins Jr. of the Orioles. In the outfield, check this out. There were two Oakland A's, Jose Canseco and Ricky Henderson. And then, of course, the greatest player in baseball back then and still maybe the most popular player of all time, or one of the most popular players of all time, Ken Griffey Jr.
I love it.
It's nap time.
All right, Grody, NFL owners voted this week to open the door for NFL players to participate in the Summer Olympics in the flag football competition, which will be making its debut as an Olympic sport in the 2028 LA Games. We had an opportunity this week to take the pulse of at least one bear at Hallis Hall. We weren't going to do it with Grady Jarrett. He doesn't seem like he would be a great flag football fit.
We weren't going to
do
it
with Joe Tooney. Yeah. He didn't seem like a great flag football fit. So we talked to Kevin Byard and asked him for his thoughts on flag football in the Olympics. Take a listen to Kevin Byard.
Kevin, the door opened this week for NFL players to play flag football in the Olympics. What kind of reaction do you have? Is something you'd be interested in?
No, honestly, I think for any athlete to be able to have the opportunity to go and get a gold medal for our country, I think that's an enormous opportunity, and it's a blessing. Would I want to play? Probably not. If you asked me probably five, some years ago, I probably would be one of the guys front line. But I did hear something about, I think it would be during training camp. So, obviously, like I said, I don't want to speak too soon, but I just don't know how that would work. But, man, I think we got a lot of guys on our team that probably can do it. Shoot, I'm not sure he's going to want to do it, but I think Caleb would be an excellent flag football team quarterback, especially with just being able to broken plays and be able to scramble around, do those type of things. So, but no, I think it's a blessing for sure.
Different for you 5 years ago?
Hey, didn't have as many kids as I have, you know what I mean? Got a lot of responsibilities I got during the summer. I don't know if that's something I'd be looking forward to.
So KB's got some parental responsibilities, but he's volunteered Caleb Williams, who on a Bears social media video in which players were asked who of their teammates would make a good flag football participant in the Olympics. Caleb volunteered himself as well. So maybe we get Caleb in the LA Games in Los Angeles. Tyson Bagent also volunteered. Caleb Williams.
He'd be good too.
Tyson said, one play drives from Caleb. And then he said, put me everywhere. Your boy T Nasty should go as well. So
I love it.
No.
I did my flag football story is years ago. Not that many years ago. I got to do the announcing for a flag football game on Lakeshore Drive, like one of the parks like right across from the lake, near Castaways, which is obviously on the lake. There was a charity game going on. It's a whole thing. I don't know if they still do it. It's a really cool thing. It's the blondes versus the brunettes. It's a female flag football game.
Tell me more.
So Dan Levy and I got to do the game, and it was out loud on the PA. So we're attempting to do these games, and you know, we got Lakeshore Drive right behind us, and for some reason I thought it would be funny to constantly say during the breaks, does anybody know where Lakeshore Drive is? I'm looking for Lakeshore Drive. And I had people come up to me and be like, hey, just so you know, Lakeshore
right
Drive is.
And
Lakeshore Drive, does anybody know where Lakeshore Drive? But we had a blast doing this game. We went to the post party at Castaways, which, as you can imagine, was just an absolute blast. The brunettes won the game,
okay,
by the way. But I have to say, like, the capper to this story is about 2 years later, I started dating a woman who played in that game, but neither of us knew. Like, I did not meet, like, I probably came across her that night.
Was she blonde or brunette?
She was a blonde.
Okay.
She was a blonde.
She was on the losing team.
Shout out to Alicia. She lives in Arizona, and I'm married with three beautiful children. She moved on. Yes, she did. But it was hilarious because we figured it out, and I had not met her that night, but we had a wonderful year together. It was pure magic, Dan.
Big ups to Alicia.
Yeah,
big ups to Alicia.
Yeah, that's right. I get along with my ex-girlfriends. That's right.
Wait, are you the Lakeshore Drive guy? Is that the first line?
Does anybody know where Lakeshore Drive is? Excuse me, sir. Just so you know, Lakeshore Drive. I was like, yeah, I'm from Kentucky. Sorry. They just brought me in to do this game. Didn't know where it was.
Let's rewrite our 12:45 segment to talk more about you and Alicia.
Okay. Absolutely. Hey.
I second that.
She's a beautiful woman. Maybe we can get her on the phone. No, I wouldn't do that to her. No. We follow each other on Instagram. That's enough. You know what I'm saying? All right. We do need to take a break. When we come back, five on it. We got five great questions that Dan Wiederer and me, Mark Grody, are going to kick around on the Raheem and Harris Show on The Score.